Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Whatnot, the online site and mobile app for collectors. Whether it's books, Pokemon, or vinyl records, Whatnot is a fast and fun way to enrich your collection. Download the Whatnot app and check the link in this episode page for $10 towards your first purchase of vinyl records on Whatnot. It's like I'm giving you a $10 bill to buy a record. It's super easy. Download the Whatnot app today and check out the auctions of vinyl records and Whatnot. Well, hey everyone, it's Nate. Welcome to episode 353 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And man, oh man, we've got a fantastic guest today. Former Three Dog Night frontman, vinyl warrior, and survivor of many close calls, Mr. Chuck Negron. Now, Chuck, as you know, was the singer and frontman of the 1970s juggernaut Three Dog Night, arguably the biggest band in the world for several years, with 21 consecutive top 40 hits and selling over 50 million records worldwide. And while you may think of songs like One and Joy to the World as adult contemporary and maybe on the softer side of rock, Three Dog Night partied like The Who, Guns N' Roses, and Led Zeppelin all wrapped into one. Their legendary wake is well documented in Chuck's book, Three Dog Nightmare, which I encourage people to get from chucknegron.com. There's autographed copies available, and it is an amazing read, an absolute page-turner. Three Dog Nightmare at chucknegron.com. And today, Chuck and I talk all about the rare records of Three Dog Night, of which there were many, several albums issued, then recalled for various reasons. We also talk about his early singles, the records that he put out, the private pressings, his original contract with Columbia Records, working with Brian Wilson, hanging out with Frank Zappa. Chuck also shares some stories of the sordid years and much, much more. And by the way, Chuck wants you to know he's got a weekly show on the Whatnot platform every Wednesday night, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. Whatnot, if you're unaware, it's an online auction site where you can buy records and collectibles direct from dealers, and I've personally used the Whatnot platform, and I've bought some fantastic records through it, so I can attest to its ease of use and effectiveness. Download the Whatnot app now. It's way easier than eBay and a lot more fun than Discogs. And if you go to this episode page at thevinylguide.com, I've got a link that will get you $10 off your first Whatnot purchase. Chuck is on there every Wednesday sharing his collectibles, sharing stories, much, much more. Check it out. It's Whatnot, and it's pretty damn rad. And hey, once you're done listening to our conversation with Chuck, we have plenty of other interviews and episodes of The Vinyl Guide you can check out, including Kenny Jones of The Who, The Faces, The Small Faces, episode 339 of The Vinyl Guide, Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull, episode 321, Tommy Chong, episode 320, Alan Parsons, episode 310, Robbie Krieger of The Doors, episode 306, Tom Schultz of Boston, episode 297, and many, many, many more. Subscribe to The Vinyl Guide in your podcast app. It's 100% free. Scroll, download, listen, and enjoy. Alrighty, folks, enough of the chit-chat. Let's get into our conversation with Mr. Chuck Negron, formerly of Three Dog Night. All right. Well, Chuck, here on The Vinyl Guide, we celebrate records and collectibles. And I got to tell you, you have such a long, rich history of music and records and vinyl. And I'm keen to jump into it with you. I got to tell you, sure. I just read this book, Three Dog Nightmare, and it is amazing. I get a lot of books, Chuck, and I got to tell you, I went through this one, it was such a page turner in about 3 days. It is an amazing story. I could not put it down.
Yeah, well, we were hoping, we get something that would help some people. And, I had looked at other books that some of my peers had done, and I was, disappointed that they glamorized things that were actually pretty sad or tragic. So I went about writing a book that would be painfully honest.
Yeah, you laid it all out there, and wow. I'm very happy that you're here talking with us. I'm very surprised how you're able to walk after everything that happened in this book.
Yeah, right. I agree.
So, Cool. So let's get back in the time machine here. Now with vinyl records, I was surprised to learn that, you know, music wasn't your first love. It was basketball. Is that right?
Yeah. I grew up in the Bronx, and, you know, we, all the kids, they were pre-boomers and boomers. So there, you know, like 20 of us that, you know, grew up. And so there were a lot of sports, and, you know, we had the schoolyard, and, you know, really didn't have any money for any, you know, anything else. So we, you know, I started to excel in that. And it was something I loved. I just loved all sports. And then finally I started really doing well in the basketball. So, and then I sang as well. I loved the singing. I made my first record with a friend, Bobby Bataria, in 1958. I guess I was 15. And, so I loved doing it, but my passion was sports, basketball.
Right. And that first record, now, I've been able to track down a few of the records that you made during this early period, but I'm sure there may be some that I haven't been able to find. Which was that record you said, the first one?
Well, this was a record that was a song called Oh Baby, and I don't even have a copy of that. Actually, Dream, which was the Everly Brothers' Dream, we did a version of that. And, you know, I don't even have copies of that. So, but it was just, you know, like a regional thing in the city, you know, wasn't on any major. It was actually Bronx Records, which is a guy that was a distributor, had a little shop where he would distribute the records, and he would release the record from time to time. But anyway, and then the next was the Rondells, and there were literally no, I have some copies, but nothing, you know, no records. And then the next were Chuck Rondell with the Sarge Brothers on Marlinda. Were you able to find a Marlinda record?
Yeah, I was able to find the Marlinda. Chuck Rondell, that's when...
I'm a Heart fan. I Dream of an Angel.
Yes, yeah. Well, there's two of them, I thought. There was the Heart Van and the Marlinda Records.
Yeah, two different labels, yeah.
Yeah, okay. But the other one was, sorry, it was called Bronx Records?
Yeah, Bronx Records, and it was just, a regional mm-hmm. thing. I mean, I don't even know where he printed these things. but I remember taking it to Bruce Morrow. Actually, it was my friend Bobby Bataria, who was really the driving force. It was his passion, was music. And I kind of, you know, I went along because I thought it was fun singing and I loved it. But, you know, I never thought of it as something I would do. It was just something I enjoyed doing. So we went to Bruce Morrow and gave them, you know, the Rondell, actually it was the Rondell's record. And, He did play it, but that, you know, that was, so we did get to hear it once, but that was about it.
And they may have given you a couple of copies, but those have been lost to time. I imagine there's probably only maybe 100 or 200.
Well, he might not even have made that many. You know what I'm saying? You know, he had like a little, it was, back in the days, I had these little, storefronts. Storefronts, and he would be all, you know, you wouldn't know it was in there. You'd go in there, and he had all these records and albums that he would distribute for the record companies. He'd be a distributor in that area. You know, it was really mom and pop stuff in the beginning, you know, and because you got to remember, that was the beginning of rock and roll. I mean, you know, the big labels had all the big artists, but these other things, just little tiny labels. So anyway, so he... you know, he got this little Bronx. He had something else too, but that I don't remember what it was. Some other label, but anyway. And but you know, I'm sure he, because I remember he wouldn't really give us any. You know, like
right. Yeah, automatically eating in his profits. But so how far between Bronx Records and Marlinda or Hartfan? Which one came after Bronx Records?
Well, after Bronx Records was, I guess, in 50, 59 and Marlinda was 61.
Okay.
So Marlinda was 61, and then I Dream of an Angel was 62, 63. And that actually hit the charts in Central California, up and down the coast, all the way as far as Bakersfield. From Bakersfield to like Santa Maria Salvang. So, you know, you could have regional hits back then, you know, and so, and right. That's why Columbia came calling, because they saw, you know, I was selling some records.
Right. And Hart Van was a Southern California and Anaheim based label.
Yeah. I think it was primarily a surf, you know, a kind of a surf record thing.
Yeah. They only had a handful of releases. So do you remember how you got their attention? How they came knocking on your door?
Well, you know, I don't know, because back then, you know, I was in college. I was playing college basketball. So when I was doing these shows, you know, the promoter who became my manager and just the greatest guy, his family was Frank Salazar, and just wonderful people. And, he found this little label, and then he got Hart Van. I don't know how he got Hart Van, but then he got Columbia. You know, so, I mean, this guy... You know, I was making records my first year in college, then my second year in college, and the next year I'm on Columbia Records. So it was pretty quick when you think about it.
Yeah. So you were playing basketball in college in Santa Maria, and you had this deal with Columbia Records at the same time.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty incredible situation to be in.
Yeah, but you know what? I was very naive because, I never thought that I was putting my recording career in jeopardy by finishing out the season, because we had won the league and we were going to the state championships to play all the best teams in California. And, you know, when I told them, I said, well, no, I really can't. You know, I'm not available to record. And they went, what? Alan Stanton, who was the vice president of Columbia, at one point, I think he was the president. Anyway, he called me up and he said, what are you talking about? You have a game, you know? And then he said, son, listen, this is serious stuff. We have people here every day that are great talents trying to get a deal. We signed you because we have, you know, we really think you could be great. And you're squandering this. You know, you need to forget this basketball and do this. Or you know what? We're not interested, because this is, you know, this is going to take everything
you
have.
You can't be halfway in.
Yeah, yeah. This is going to take everything you got. And I didn't listen. I finished the year. And then when I got there, although we made some records, I'd lost a lot of the excitement that was initially there. I squandered, and I learned a big lesson, because when that first record, which, you know, the material I had was just, it just wasn't right. The material I brought, my producer just wasn't into. After that, I have a little battle getting people interested again. And so that's when I really made the commitment. Hey, this is, you know, I'm not going back to school. Because Bill Sharman played for the Boston Celtics. He was on the championship teams with Bob Cousy and Bill Russell. And then he became the coach of the Lakers. He was a coach of the Lakers for a while. And then he was a general manager of the Los Angeles Lakers. He's a Hall of Famer. Anyway, he was the coach of Cal State LA, and he'd given me a deal, a scholarship to go there, you know, after I left Hancock. That's when I made up my mind. I said, you know, I got to leave school. Because I knew once I left school, I was never going to play ball again, because, you know, I wasn't going to play pro ball, but, so my real years of high level ball were gonna be over. So, but I did it, and you know, I got lucky. I did it just in time, to meet Danny and Corey, mm-hmm. and you know, great.
So that record, All's Fair in Love and War. And again, it's under a different, it's under Chuck Rondell, which is a pseudonym you picked out. That, if I understand correctly, Columbia were trying to mold you more into a crooner rather than rock and roll. Is that a fair
summary? Yeah, oh no, it was a totally crooner. The other side was actually the single was Speak for Yourself, John. And, yeah, it was this you know, kind of real soft pop. You know, they just lost Johnny Mathis was leaving the label, and they really wanted me. They thought I could fit in, you know, into this thing. So they were being very. But my producer was anyway Ed Kleban, who also produced Igor Stravinsky. So you know you can, and also he wrote a chorus line.
Oh.
He ended up being he ends be the writer of a chorus line. So you know I really wasn't happy with the material that we had, but that was the kind of that was the stuff. But what I did get to see was the best musicians in L.A. because I mean on the session on piano was Leon Russell, on guitar was Glenn Campbell. I had the whole Wrecking Crew, all of the guys that played on Brian Wilson and all those those albums. David Gates wrote the charts, and we all sang backwards. The background on All's Fair and Love More is David Gates, Glenn Campbell, Leon Russell, and me. Do do be do ba do do. And I go with all those voices. The dumbest part in the world. It was just a silly background part.
But they put a lot of firepower behind you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, they were. Hey, no, they were ready to make me a big star. And I actually hurt that process because, you know, they had. Look, when I first got there, I mean, they had me going to premieres, movie premieres, they were telling me, you know, that I was too, the way I dressed was too conservative because I was a college kid. Mm. And, they would send me to parties and I'd meet all these rockers and they were really trying to kind of hit me up a little bit.
So before we get into the Three Dog Night era, are there any other records that you were involved in that you made besides Bronx, Marlinda, Hart Van, and that Columbia Records single?
No, I made some other records while on Hart Van, but they never came out. Actually, I wish I knew where the tapes were, but they never came out. This, I swear, the remake of the Sky Lounge song I did. But no, I don't think there's any. I did record a record with Tim Alvarado, who was Danny Hutton's producer at one time. Mm-hmm. But he has the masters, and we never did anything with those. That was right before Three Dog Night.
Okay. And is that part of the Redwood project?
No, that was before that. That was before.
Okay.
I'll tell you what period it was. I was living in Tim's guest house, and this guy shows up, and I met him with Crazy Horse and some of the guys, and Neil Young, which Crazy Horse was his band, and this guy had asked them if he knew any really good singers because he was looking for a guy to sing this track. So they said me. So he came out and he plays the track. And I'd never heard anything like it in my life. But this is the greatest thing I've ever heard. So he said, "Well, I need a record of yours because I want to take it back to Brian." It was Good Vibrations. And Brian was looking for someone to sing it because he didn't want the Beach Boys to do it. And I don't know why, and evidently he wasn't thinking of himself for doing it. So all I had was my Columbia record stuff. And I said, "This is not going to get me a deal here. Why don't you just let me go with you? And I'll sing the song." He's, "Oh, no, Brian, what? You know, Brian's not going to let you come." And I, why not? You know, I didn't know Brian was a little different.
Brian was a huge supporter of you and
oh, he loved us.
Yeah.
Oh, he was our first producer. Redwood was before Three Dog Night. And we did, we were going to do a whole album with Brian. And we we recorded Time to Get Alone, and we were getting ready. We had the track to Darlin', and we never got a chance to put the vocals down on Darlin' because Mike Love and Carl and, you know, they came in and, you know, said, hey, you got to, we want these songs. You know, you can't abandon the family, you know, because they knew Brian wanted to separate. He wanted to do his own thing, and they just weren't ready to let him go.
Yeah, you wrote in the book how they somewhat browbeat him.
Oh, it's terrible! Oh, no, it was terrible to see. It was sad. And now here we are at that point. I'm living in my car. I mean, just I'm living in my car because it was at that particular time when we were making those recordings, and oh, I forgot my train. Oh. And we're in there, we're singing, and Brian's little guys are here, and he goes in the control room, and the three of us are standing there, and we're watching this thing unfold as Brian's face starts changing from this happy thing, this really sad thing. Then he started to look like a little boy being scolded, and then he looked like he's crying. And I went, what are they doing to him?
Mm.
And it was really sad. And then he walked out like a little... like a kid, little kid who'd done something wrong. He said, they won't let me do it. I'm sorry. No. And we felt so bad. And I'm living in my car. But don't know. We're fine. Don't worry. I mean, we were so worried about him. But those guys had no idea how they were affecting us. I mean, they were just thinking of themselves. You know, yeah. And Brian said, look, I'll give you the money to finish the album. You do it yourselves. And we just wanted to get out of there. Because... we went this. It was painful to watch, and it was demoralizing to see. And we didn't want to be involved with that, you know. And in spite of that, we desperately needed it, and you know. So that was that.
So, were there ever any recordings of Redwood that were somewhat finished? Have they ever?
Yeah,
surfaced?
Yeah. There's one on Three Dog Nights. We have. We have a version. We have Time to Get Along. The song that's on Three Dog Night Celebrate. I guess it's Celebrate. Three Dog Night Celebrate. The Three Dog Night Story.
Okay.
And the record that we finished is on there. Yeah, there is a completed record. So yeah, that's on there. And Brian. After that, I mean, Brian's always supported us and was always a friend and. A gentleman, and I'm just so happy to see that he tours and that his, he has this wonderful wife who has given him the strength to do things he never would have done without her.
So going into the Three Dog Night era, and again, we talk a lot about records and some of the collectibles and some of the oddities about them. In the album Suitable for Framing, there is a credit to the GTOs, which I believe was around the picture Inside the Gatefold. GTO's,
yes.
Girls Together Outrageously, Frank Zappa's act. Were they on the album at all in terms of singing or vocally, or
no.
Was it just the picture?
No, they weren't. They were people we knew, from the area. Of course, we didn't really speak. Speak to them. We really did, But anyway, Ed had taken some shots of them, and he said they'd be great to use. And so we met. We had a wonderful day. It was fun. And I still know to this day Miss Pamela, and some of the ladies have passed away, a couple in the last couple of years. But they were a part of the LA scene. There was quite a creative. Scene going on there, and they were a part of it.
Mm. Did you?
But no, they did not sing with us.
Okay. Did you ever have much involvement in Frank Zappa? Did you ever appear on any of his recordings or deal with him in any way?
No. The very interesting thing, though, before I even met Corey, before on the Three Dog Night level, I'd seen Corey at the Whiskey Inn, but I hadn't met him. Danny and I. Went to the Mothers of Invention's first album, Frank's first album, the very first album. We were there, and so was Corey. So you can't believe the number of people were there. I said, Is this they're actually recording? Because, you know, I've been on Columbia. I mean, it was a whole other deal. There are people everywhere in the studio, outside. I mean, hundreds of people. And so I met Frank then. And then he initially heard us at a rehearsal or something. And he really liked us. He hired us to do a gig. He was promoting some shows just to get his band out there. Because he had this little following. And he actually booked us. And we played right before the Mother did at, you know, before no one knew. I mean, I don't even know if we were Three Dog Night. I think we were Tricycle then. We would just use different names each time we, 6 foot three, Tricycle. You know, all these silly names, you know. And, you know, so, you know, so Frank was a real fan. And, and like I said, he booked us, and he was, yeah, he liked us, and as far as Frank goes, he was, you know, we did do shows with him, and he had the command of an audience. He was just just fantastic. He was, you know, quite a showman and a very brave, in my opinion, a very brave, committed man, because I can't hear a melody in any song he's ever written. You know, he does his own thing, you know, and, you know, I guess it's musically, it's almost like, you know, an academic exercise in what he knows. And I don't know how well it translates into a musical experience for me, but I know it does for many people, you know, so it's, you know, and that's what makes the world go round. But I always enjoyed listening to him because he, you know, live, because just, I saw him at a show, it might have been the Denver Pop Festival, where there's a lot going on, and the police was shooting smoke gas at people trying to jump the fences and everything. And when things are pretty hectic, he stopped everything and he said, okay, listen, I want you people over here. I want you guys all to, like, make fart sounds, like, okay? And over here, I want you to go, and he'd go one side, and then the other side, and he goes down both together, and it was just, and he literally changed a scene that could have been very, very dangerous into something that was just completely, and he did that. He did that. And I will ever respect him for the power to transform something that could have been very, very terrible into a moment of entertainment.
Just de-escalated, you know, the whole situation.
He de-escalated the whole thing. And I hope those people and those police thanked him, because it was amazing what he did. I learned a lot from him, just watching him.
So around this time, you were in L.A. Obviously, this the environment was, you know, vibrant with musicians and different people playing with one another. Have you appeared on records that maybe we would know about that you haven't been credited on?
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey, record nerds. Don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits.
So around this time, you were in L.A. Obviously, this the environment was, you know, vibrant with musicians and different people playing with one another. Have you appeared on records that maybe we would know about that you haven't been credited on?
I did some stuff on the Blues Image. Not the, it's the Blues Image or the, no, what's that, the group from New York? The not the Blues Image, the something blue. Oh, anyway, I did some background stuff on their stuff. And I'm trying to think what else. You know, I'll be honest, I wasn't a social musician, like so many of those guys. So I missed out on a lot of those experiences. But it wasn't exciting or for me to go and just jam or hang out. And you know, I don't know why. Maybe it was I was just so shy, because I was very shy for quite a long time, and you know, it took quite an amount of drugs to loosen me up. and then in the end, I got a little too loose. So I didn't do it. I did do some stuff, but I don't think it ever got on them. Corey Deanna and I did background for Stephen Stills on one of his first solo records. Mm. And I don't know if it ever got on or not. I really don't know. We did some stuff with him. And, you know, I'm trying to think. There are people, but I can't.
Any opportunities that you kind of blew off that maybe now you wish you said yes to?
Well, Cher propositioned me.
Sonny wasn't going to be in the corner watching, was he?
No, it was after him.
Okay.
She was on the hunt.
Fresh meat.
Yeah, right. So I'm trying to think. There were things that I passed because I knew I couldn't do them because of the drugs. Like right when Three Dog Night ended, I got a lot of offers to do a lot of different things, and I passed on them because I just
you were in no shape.
I knew I'd let them down, and I just, why get into it if I'm going to have people put a lot of money into a guy that's just not going to be able to make it every night, you know? So, right. And I wish I remembered some of the names, but they were big players.
So that's interesting because if you got those propositions, if you got those offers and then you declined them because you knew you wouldn't be able to follow through, at least you were conscientious of, you weren't fooling yourself. Of the fact.
No. I never wanted to embarrass myself. Because Three Dog Night, because I wrote the book, there's a big misconception that I brought down the band. That's not the case. I gave them their first million seller and their last million seller. And then after that, I gave them their last top 40 song, the very last single, Till the World Ends. I didn't. Danny's gone by now. He's been let go, fired. For drugs and alcohol, and Joe Shermy's been fired for drugs and alcohol, and there's basically Corey, Jimmy Greenspoon, and me left, and the very last show at the Greek Theater in '76 was us, and that was it. I mean, none of the original guys are left. So I did that work, but then when it ended, I was a very wealthy guy I could do what I wanted, and I didn't think I'd get in the kind of trouble I did, so. I learned not to, I mean, I was not going to do anything. And to be quite honest, I went again. Oh, God, it's a terrible story. But, you want me to tell you the story?
Hey, only if you feel comfortable with it. If it's terrible, don't worry about it.
Okay, so anyway, I passed on all this stuff. This label, that label, RCA offers me $3 million to sign with them. All this. But a friend of mine I grew up with, he was the connection, so I wasn't going to do that to him because he worked for RCA. All these reasons why. And anyway, so I get pretty bad, and I end up with hepatitis C. So I get so bad, I walk into a doctor's office. He quarantines the whole place and puts me in the hospital. He says, you're going to die, man. You're really bad. So I'm in the hospital, and before I'd gotten in there, I had been jamming with the guys, Joe Shermy, Floyd Sneed, Michael Alsup, the original, and Jimmy, the original rhythm section of the of the band, the musicians. And Danny and Corey had heard that. But anyway, so when I was in the hospital, they called my father and said, we'd like Chuck to come to a meeting, they knew I was in the hospital. So anyway, my dad said, you got to go to this meeting. They're having it on Tuesday. It was Monday. You're having it on Tuesday. If you're not there, that's it. They're never going to see you again. And like, you know, I went, Dad, I'm in the hospital. Come on. Mm-hmm. You just call my room. You know, I don't even know if I can leave. I might still be in quarantine. Anyway, I was able to, you know, I wasn't going to do it. My dad came and begged me. And I couldn't tell him, Dad, I'm a junkie. Dad, I couldn't tell him. I couldn't tell him. And he said, no, because he was a very passionate Latin man. And son, we're going to do it all again. You're going to be great. You know, look at you. You look great. You know, come on. You know, we'll do it. I'll take you there. I'll cover your back. I couldn't tell. I couldn't do it. I couldn't tell. So I went. And they manipulated my dad. And when I got there, they had a contract for me to sign. I said, first of all, I don't have a lawyer. Second of all, I need to read it. Then they went, no, you're going to sign this right now or it's over. And I went, well, it's over then. I left and my dad came running out and he was crying. He was crying. And I couldn't do it. I mean, I had to do it for him. I had to do it. I couldn't tell him. And I went in and I signed it. Else I wouldn't have been back. I would have never done it. And I tried my best. I was sick and I just couldn't get through it. I couldn't get through it, you know, and I never would have been, I would have never gone through or put, you know, those guys, that was in 81 and I left in 85, you know, and in 85, they were taking me, I was in the hospital during the week and on the weekends, you probably read this, I was taken out and we worked. And the doctors had told them that I was getting sicker and weaker and don't you notice how frail he's getting, because this stuff of detoxing him during a week and then giving him medication on the weekends killing him. So they set up an intervention, unbeknownst to Danny Corey and the guys. And at a show in San Diego, they had an intervention team of AA and NA guys. And they kidnapped me after the show. And they took me to a hospital that no one knew. And I was in there a month before they found me and they sued me. You get out right now or we're suing you. And I said, that's it. I'm done. Because I was dying. I was, you know, yeah. I was dying. And, you know, so that was that. And, it was sad. But you know, if I hadn't have been involved in drugs, that wouldn't have happened. But the end of Three Dog Night was almost inevitable once we lost Joe. Because Joe was really important part of that rhythm section because of what Floyd. Floyd was a very unique drummer. He had a very unique style, but you had to buy into it to keep him in line, to keep Floyd in line, else he'd play too much. So Joe did that. But as soon as Joe was gone, it was like, oh, God. And, you know, then, of course, when Danny stopped showing up, you can't do three-part harmony with two guys. So we started singing our own harmony because we needed to finish the record. So Corey'd come and do his songs. He'd sing all the parts himself. He'd go to home to go to bed. I'd come in. I'd sing all my parts again. And we're making records where we're doing our own records. I'm doing mine. He's doing his. And, luckily we still have an hit. But, you know, it was – and then, you know, then we started fighting and – the sorriest thing to me was Corey. Corey didn't deserve any of this. Corey's just a stand-up pro, didn't use drugs, had a family, just showing up to work, and he had to watch this happen under his eyes. He couldn't stop it, and I think that must have been heartbreaking for him because all he wanted, you know, was to keep the house in Malibu and everything he worked for, and, you know, and we were putting all of that in jeopardy.
Well, there's a lot of dark times in the story of Three Dog Night, and you've spoken quite in depth about them in the book, and I would refer anyone to check out the book Three Dog Nightmare. It goes very, very deep into detail. I only had a couple of questions about some of those times, and one of them was I heard a story, and I don't think it was in the book. I heard a story that at one point you had traded an apartment building for $35,000 in cash, just so you could do drugs. Is that correct?
Okay, so what it was I was in a little trouble. I'd kind of played a couple of people that had actually shot into my house. One shot went into my car, another one came right in through the living room. And so I had debts. And plus I was drugs. I was drug sick. So anyway, I heard that the apartment building that we owned, that they were thinking of putting it up for sale. And Danny Corey and I were partners in it. And I contacted the guy that used to be our old business manager. And in fact, he was still managing the building. So I said, I'd like to sell my share. And he said, well, I'll buy it. And I said, cool. He said, what would he give you? And he said, well, let's see. You put in 25. I'll give you 35. Well, why would he put 25? First of all, we built the place. I don't know. We built the place. And that was it. And you know what? That was it. And I said, okay, I'll take it. So yeah. It was like this apartment, this was condos. The main suites had elevators, the two stories had elevators.
Was this L.A.?
Beverly Hills.
Beverly Hills, okay.
Yeah, Beverly Hills. Stindle? I can't remember the street. Anyway, they were nice. They were really nice. They were condos before condos. Mm-hmm. That is a true story. I mean, you know, my share was, you know, barely not millions of dollars. You know, I mean, at least a million. I mean, right. It was what was at that point? I guess it was the 90s.
Oh, today it'd be astronomical.
Yeah, thanks. Oh, that place now. Oh my God. So anyway, yeah. So that's true. That's true.
Okay. In the book, you also talked about selling your gold records at a pawn shop at one point. And I see that they actually come up for sale every so often. A Chuck Negron gold record.
You see more than that? I see Joe Shermy.
Oh, you see Joe's as well. Okay.
Joe's. I see mine once in a while, but actually I've really never seen many of mine because people have bought them because people have offered for me to buy them from them. I mean, the people that, I said, you know what? I don't want them because they just represent something bad. And what happened was when I got my first year clean, one of the presents was three of the albums. And I was told that each year I would get one of the presents would be. And, you know, albums, so at this point, I have them all back. So, I got them all back. And they mean something because they represent my sobriety and, you know, and something that I really earned. Not that I didn't earn the other ones. But they're, you know, all RIA, you know, same, you know, just reordered them. So, yeah, so it's really nice thing. But I never wanted to buy those back because, someone said, look, I'll give them to you then. I said, well, you know what? I don't want them. I'll get them back. And that's how I got it back. It would each, you know, I'm 30 years, so I'll be 31 in September, 31 years clean and sober. So, you know, I've had them back for a while.
Okay. I didn't realize you'd actually got some of them back.
I got them all back.
Wow. Okay.
I got an Aaliyah. And I just got. Which really shows the cheapness of these labels now. I just got a platinum record it's one platinum record that represents that. Here, hold on one second. Mm-hmm. Here, look, right behind me.
Oh, yeah. Beautiful.
Okay, so that represents 11 platinum albums. So assholes give us one record for 11 platinum records, you know. But anyway, yeah. So
the music business ain't what it used to be.
No, it ain't. But I got here. Look.
Wow.
And it goes down. It's two stories.
Oh man.
Yeah, it's two stories.
Wow, fantastic. So, going to, again, with Rare Records, it ain't easy.
I've done this a while. Go on.
So going back a little ways, it ain't easy. The original cover, the original title.
Yeah.
The original cover of that album had the band, as I understand, naked, covered in orange. Is that right?
Yeah. They used that later on for the inside of some record. But yeah, it's we're the Wizards of Orange.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all, yeah. And let me tell you something. That paint was oil-based. I had some of that on for a year. I couldn't get oil. I mean, there were parts, you know, all of a sudden I walk away, you know, I have a rendezvous, and I walk away and said, there's something orange on your ass, you know. I go, what?
It's hard to get out of all those areas.
But I mean, it was oil based, and I could never get it off my shower. One of my shower walls, I just could not get it off.
So you guys took that picture, you turned it in, the record company printed up hundreds of thousands of copies, if not more. They all went out, and then they got recalled, but a few got out in the wild, as I understand.
Yeah, a few did. Not Walmart, but, you know, those big vendors, you know, they didn't want anything to do with it. So, you know, we had to change. And the whole concept was changed from Wizards of Orange, and it ain't easy. Because we had a whole concept. It was original material. It was, you know, they changed everything.
So that original record, if you could find one, well over $500 for a copy of that.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I think my wife did find one. I think it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
Actually, like the hardcover of that book.
Yeah.
$500-$700.
Yeah.
You would have a hardcover. And then there's a lenticular cover. A three-dimensional cover. That is...
You got one handy?
I'm going to try to see. Someone must have cleaned up this place.
Thank goodness for that. Another collectible of your career is the Hard Labor original cover.
Yeah, that was a little much.
I look at that cover and I'm like, wow, there's a lot of cocaine in the 70s. What the?
and psychedelics.
Can you please describe that cover for those that are unfamiliar with it?
Well, the part that really got it banned was, okay, so we have an operating room, where a baby is born, with all the doctors and nurses that would be required, and all the equipment that you would need, and you have a woman lying, you know, down in stirrups, mm-hmm. and of course, you know, she's covered appropriately, and one of the doctors holding what do they call them, stirrups?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, big
forceps.
Tongs.
Forceps. Holding with forceps, an album that had just given birth, but it was very greasy.
Well, I got to correct you, Chuck. It wasn't a woman.
Oh, no, it was. Yeah, there was a woman, but they had a mask on her, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that was actually June Fairchild. Now, June Fairchild was was an actress. She was in movies with Rock Hudson, The Pretty Little Things, and she had a nice little career going for a while, and then drugs. But she was also the Ajax lady in the Up in Smoke, Cheech and Chong.
Oh yeah,
she was the Ajax lady. Where Ajax is spilled by accident, and she thinks it's coke.
That's how you do know. Yeah.
So that's her. So yeah, they have this mask, and then her feet were some kind of reptile feet or something.
Yeah, it looks like a half alien, half chicken kind of thing.
Yeah. So that was June.
So that cover, as I understand, again, several hundred thousand went out, and then it got recalled or it got changed.
Oh, yeah, they were very upset about that.
Yeah.
Although Dunhill liked it. Now they were liking it. They're getting press and all this stuff. But they put a Band-Aid on it pretty quick.
How involved were you and Danny and Corey with the cover artwork and all the...
We helped put all that stuff together. Although, we didn't do that one. And we wouldn't have gone that far. It would have been... We wouldn't have... You know, the greasy... I mean, the... Vaseline or whatever it was that made it look like afterbirth or whatever. We wouldn't have done that, you know. I mean, we would have, you know, you're giving birth to a record would have been like a beautiful thing, like holding it in your arms, you know, as opposed to, you know, whatever they do.
I thought what else was interesting, because within that original cover, there was a manila folder.
Oh, yeah.
They had the birth records, and yeah. Even for the record nerds out there, it says things like the mother stamp was so-and-so. So it really kind of unfolds on a few different levels there.
Yeah, no, it was a very clever thing, and you know, and it was very well thought of. I mean, that's, by the way, there's a great, in Japan, they put out all the Three Dog Night records, the whole thing, in CD size, with the exact albums. In other words, they're with the chart and everything in it. You know, all the records. It's, you know, so I have this. My little kids, you see that chart there?
They're very fiducious about those details. So yeah, that's
unbelievable. Yeah, God bless them.
So Chuck, you've been very generous with your time, and I want to thank you for that.
Thank you.
I know you do a Whatnot show.
I do a Whatnot show, and we do a lot of, there was a fan who became a collector, and but the majority of stuff he was collecting was Three Dog Night stuff. So I knew him, you know, so, and one day he contacted me, and I found out his daughter had cancer. And, anyway, I'd heard that he was selling his stuff. So I bought it. So now I have hundreds and hundreds of singles and albums, you know, and, you know, some of them with the covers, the nude cover, and, you know. So anyway, so we have the show and we sell them, and also we collect all sorts of collectibles that you very rarely see, you know. So
yeah.
You can't see it now. Anyway, there's a little billboard, a poster from the show we did with Led Zeppelin, which is in Portland in 1969. The stuff you can find, unbelievable stuff you can find. So anyway, we do the show on Wednesday at 5 p.m. Pacific time. And it's, you know, we have fun. My daughter did it with me last week. My youngest is 21. She's home from DePaul University. My oldest is 52. So I got him 21, 28. Then we jumped to 44, 48, 52.
Ah. Well, you're very blessed to be able to be here to have kids that are,
Look at me. I'm like a stud.
You are. Yeah, absolutely. I hope I look that good when I'm
59. No, I can't believe I'm 80. I fucking can't believe I'm 80. I mean,
Jeez.
I mean, when I was a kid, I remember standing on, this is the truth, I worked out at the candy corner, candy store, and these guys just finished playing ball, and this one guy says to his friend, he said, hey, it's my birthday tomorrow. I'm going to be 30. And I remember being there behind the counter going, oh, shit, this poor guy's going to die.
Oh, my goodness. You did well, though.
It was all that ball. I'm telling you, it's all that ball. Playing all that ball.
You know what? I would suggest early part of your life spent on the basketball court built that lung capacity to be singing and built that strength to get through everything you've gotten through. So
anyway,
so Chuck, again, thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure.
I want to remind folks, Three Dog Nightmare, go to chucknegron.com. Pick up a copy of this book. It's amazing. You won't put it down. Every Wednesday, 5 p.m., on Whatnot, Chuck gets on. He'll share some stories. He'll share some collectibles. He'll talk to you about the stories behind the items. And Chuck, again, thank you so much for coming on the Vinyl Guide.
Take care, man.
Take care. Bye. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Oh, man, I got to tell you. Chuck is amazing. That book, Three Dog Nightmare, I fully encourage everyone to get it. It's an absolute page turner. It's absolutely wild. And man, I'm so,
surprised and impressed that Chuck is still with us. And thank God. I mean, what a talent. Also want to just, again, remind everyone, Chuck has a Whatnot show every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. The Whatnot app is pretty cool. Download it and check it out. It's for collectibles, not only vinyl records, but like Pokemon and books and all sorts of things you can get on Whatnot. And I've got some great deals on there personally. So check it out. And again, there's a link for $10 towards your first purchase on this episode page at thevinylguide.com. Oh, and quick one there, you Sydney Siders. I'm going to be at the Glebe Record Fair on Saturday, September 24th. And then in Auckland, New Zealand, the week of September 26th. So hit me up on socials if you're in either of those two places. I'm likely taking next week off the show just because of everything that's going on. But I've already lined up some amazing guests for when I get back. So I think you'll all be keen to hear what's in store. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Put them on your Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter. Leave us a positive review in iTunes. That is always hugely helpful. Give us 5 out of 5 or 10 out of 10 stars. You say something nice, that is always appreciated. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.